Hey, everybody. How's it going? Welcome. How are you guys doing? Yes, we are live at VGM Together. This is really great. This is now my second time doing a VGM Together event. We're really, really happy to be kicking off the staff spotlight today. We are Pixelated Audio. My name is Gene Draband, and joining me is my co-host and the podcast's creator, Brian Mosley.
Howdy. Welcome to VGM Together 2022.
We've already got some hellos in the chat. Hey, folks. So some of you may already know me. As I mentioned, I was a volunteer last year at VGM Together. I was on the music team. I worked helping for music discovery, artist discovery, and booking. And I also helped put together the band performance schedule. So if you know, kind of like the show flow, I had a big part in that, which was a lot of fun. Of course, I was not the only member on the team. I could not have done it without all of the great support from Josh and Laura, the music leads, the event coordinators, Nuge and Doug, and so many other wonderful people that helped put on the event. And, you know, we're happy to be back. The event is about talking about stuff that goes on behind the scenes. So I'll let Brian tell a little bit about himself and the podcast before we get to our topic.
Yeah. So if you haven't heard of Pixelated Audio, we're a long-running video game music podcast, started in 2014, and we cover a really broad spectrum on mostly preservation of VGM. A big part of our shows is playing music from games, but we're going to be doing that today, but we're only going to be playing some clips today for the live stream, but you can hear this after the fact in their full, you know, what, 5-minute glory or however
long. In their full glory, yeah. Yes. The show's going to be a little longer when it gets released.
Right. In addition to the music, we talk about the game on our normal show. We talk about the game, the context of the game's development, about the composers, as well as technical hardware, and some implementation aspects as well. We try to be as thorough as possible, and we also try to do that without coming off as boring, because some of the details can get really, deep in the weeds, but some of these are really interesting and help keep preservation active. So it's challenging.
A tightrope walk. Yeah, for sure. But yeah, a crucial part of our show is we often feature guests from the wider audio community, the game audio community. Sometimes it's just fans, but a lot of times we have musicians and composers. We've had some really amazing guests over the years. We spoke with Saori Kobayashi of the Panzer Dragoon series. We've had equally amazing, but maybe lesser known composers like Dane Saint. That was one of my favorite shows.
That was a really, really good show. Go back and listen to that. Yeah.
Oh, it was an amazing show. Yeah, we had Dan Hess on not too long ago of Pilot Wing 64, which led us directly to speaking with Charlie Rosen of the 8-Bit Big Band, and we were very much starstruck. We were able to record that show just before, you know, fingers crossed, we had no idea that the Grammy win was happening, so it was like we were, you know, it was in suspense. It was just an amazing moment in video game music history, and we're so proud of everything that they've accomplished.
Yeah, we've covered games and music across just this huge spectrum of stuff, from popular to obscure, usually on the obscure side because it's, you know, less in the spotlight.
That's what we do.
for just about every single platform you can think of. We gave a talk about the evolution of game audio at the Library of Congress in 2000. Was that 2018 or 19?
I think it was 2019. Yeah.
Was it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Before all the world went to shambles. But we've also done, from Library of Congress, we've also done a show on a Colgate Toothman mascot. In your Comic Sans there. Have fun doing it.
Yes, he is our unofficial mascot for the show. That's Harold Hardtooth.
Yes, a game about getting all that evil plaque off of your off your teeth. At the end of the day, though, we're just two guys that love game audio, and as long as it's good music and a good story to tell, we like to be kind of behind it as much as we can.
Exactly. So what are we talking about today, Brian?
Yeah, so today we're talking, it's kind of an ambitious, maybe too ambitious topic for, you know, the 40 minutes or so that we're given here, but we want to touch on this because it's really important and we feel like this is a good place to do it. So why are we talking about game audio logging and archiving? Well, simply put, it's the process of capturing game audio for the purpose of archiving exactly how it sounds to the technology that it was used on, or the system, or the audio formats.
Or as close as possible.
As close as possible. And why we're talking about it, A couple of reasons, actually. The first is that logging contributes to the tremendous efforts that are being done in the VGM community. But it's something that often gets taken for granted or overlooked just because, you know, it's a lot of work under the hood, I guess.
Yeah.
Big part of why you can search for just about anything on YouTube or on whatever place you're listening to your audio, Spotify or whatever, is because of this huge amount of effort that people have put into for the logging community. And second, even though Gene and I rely heavily on logged music for our shows, sometimes even we kind of gloss over how much hard work actually goes in behind the scenes to bring that music to the masses. And this is why it kind of fits perfectly in with the theme of this event is, you know, a staff spotlight, more of like a, you know, unsung heroes kind of spotlight.
Yeah, when we heard about the event, they're saying, why don't you focus on the staff members behind the scenes? And we're like, why don't we hand the baton over to people who are even more in the shadows than we are?
Yeah, it's really kind of digging deep. And again, it's an ambitious topic, and we're not going to touch on everything here, but we want to at least look at the surface layer and talk about and maybe give you a little bit more appreciation, more than you already have, for some of the music that we can listen to today a lot easier.
Yeah, and if we get any small details wrong or we gloss over things, we apologize. We got to cover a lot of ground. So
we started off with, let's just say we started off with like a million slides, and we had to narrow it down to what would fit in this budget of time. So we're going to try to be very surface on it. Anyways, let's take a break from talking about us and the show and stuff and talk about an example of video game logging. On the left here, we have an example that we're going to play. Do you want to play that and we can talk about the stuff?
Of course. Do
you want to talk about it first?
No. I want to play it first just so people have the tune in their ear.
All right. Take a listen.
So good.
Yeah.
So good. Awesome. I love that tune.
You know why we picked this, actually, or I decided to put this in there, only because this is the first episode we featured this, the first episode that Gene and I did together, actually, because it was such a fun, bouncy soundtrack, amazing composer, and we learned so much about the kind of production about this game.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it inspired us to even do a deep dive on the composer on a later episode, which is, to date, one of my favorite episodes that we ever put together.
Yep.
So,
yep.
Yeah.
So that bouncy little track, this came out for the MSX, and it was, you know, it's standard MSX music, but it has some really catchy stuff to it. And a lot of this music would never have been, you know, brought to the, you know, a Western audience, because it was released only in Japan. It's called Yudei-kun, or Mr. Ghost. And it wouldn't have made its way into our ears easily without the work that we're talking about here. People actually putting in the time to log this game, or at least find you know, something that is important to share with others.
So what's going on in that screenshot?
Yeah. So we listen to this music. It's got this fun, bouncy feel. And in the screenshot next to it is an example of what the instructions are to the sound chip itself. Now, this is VGM to text. It's part of a tool set for VGM logging. And I ran the VGM file through it, and you can kind of see this output. And it gives you things like the frequencies to play, when certain channels need to stop, when they need to rise in volume, envelope changes, and stuff like that, and all the samples. So it's kind of a visual representation of what the sound chip would have to kind of interpret and produce to make the sounds.
Should we move on? I want to
dive in.
Yeah, yeah. It's a dense topic, I'll be honest. So, you know, logging as an activity, sometimes it's actually pretty easy. You know, it's just almost as simple as just like opening up the game files and saying, oh, hey, here's the music. But, you know, you have to have at least some basic computer skills. Sometimes it's quite a lot for some of the really sophisticated ones. Generally, if you've got some programming, some light hacking skills, you can probably get pretty far. Unfortunately, with game audio logging, there's really no good way to tell how difficult a project is going to be. You can be looking at two games, same company, same system.
Same composer,
yeah.
Yeah, everything.
And the other one is like, it's going to take me like 3 weeks to figure out how they put this together, how they like crammed it in there. So if you grew up playing on like the Genesis or the Super Nintendo, you know that a lot of games came with a sound test, or sometimes CD games had music in like WAV files or MIDIs. Unfortunately, that was more of just a period of time. Nowadays, it's rarely that simple, but you know, it's sometimes you're lucky, most of the time you're not. And there's a lot of things that can complicate the process. If the data is compressed, if it's disorganized, sometimes it's stored in weird places. One, you know, half of it's in one place, another half is somewhere else. It can be in a custom data format that's only unique to that game. And if you're wondering why somebody would go through the trouble of making a custom format, well, there's a lot of reasons. The main one is probably implementation needs.
Optimization and yeah.
Oh, yeah. But the other thing is a lot of musicians are also that work in the games industry are also themselves software developers and programmers. And like, I can't get the game to do what I want it to do. So I got to write my own tools. It's just, you know, we don't have the flexibility. They either do it themselves or work with a developer. And now it makes our job harder. But,
right.
You know,
we've talked to a number of composers on the show that they've had to write their own, you know, sound drivers, which is the software that communicates to the hardware. And you know, a lot of it's custom just so they can get their needs across. I remember a good example was Matt Furness. He talked about doing some of the music when we had him on a few years ago. And he had to really work hand in hand with his engineering team doing the sound drivers to make sure the audio would come across the way that he wanted it. And that added a whole other layer of complications to things. So,
yeah,
it can be a challenge.
So just to keep things very simple, there's generally kind of three ways that you get the music out of the game. These are like categories or families. There's a lot of variability here. The first one is essentially you have the music data, whatever that means, and you play it back on some kind of hardware and you record it literally as it's coming out of your machine as a live audio recording. So some of these really hard to emulate chips just don't sound as good. So the easiest way is to boot it up on your old trusty whatever machine, figure out a way to essentially hit record, and then out comes an audio recording. The second way is kind of similar, except instead of putting it to a recording, you're pushing it out to some kind of data file. So that those kinds of instruction files, just a little bit more simple and easy to understand. Common ones are like NSF for the NES, SID for Commodore 64.
You can think of it kind of like a proxy in between the sound chip, kind of extracting that data that is being communicated to the sound hardware.
Yeah, I kind of liken it to you're telling the machine to write sheet music, essentially, which can be later played back in another player or in some other format. And the third way is sometimes, we talked about this, you do just have the audio as formats that are already easily readable. WAVs, MIDIs, MP3s. Although sometimes the game needs to be compressed in a certain way, so you kind of have to untwist it and be like, oh, so it's actually stored in a normal way, but you kind of have to go around a couple of corners to find it. So it's not always these really esoteric file formats, but, you know, game development is complex. What else can we say? So let's move it along. We talked a little bit about logging, the idea of actually doing the capture, but, you know, the thing is, logging is really just one part of the work. We mentioned explicitly at the start of the show, it's logging and archiving. I'm going to let Brian talk about this because he has a lot more experience. But man, there's so much that goes into this.
Again, remember, these are the cliff notes here, because there's really a lot to it. And, you know, every situation is so different. But really, just to give you an idea of how much effort really has to go into just a simple pack. Like we're talking about Yudekum, that Mr. Ghost that we played earlier. Think of it in multi-tiered steps here. Getting access to the music, that's a hard part right there, right? Knowing where that data lives. You know, we have the game. I wish I had the graphic of, you know, Zoolander when they're like banging the files in the computer.
I know. I was thinking about that analogy as we were writing the draft for this.
It's really hard to know where that data actually lives. And there's no way to know ahead of time without, you know, being on that engineering team.
Yeah.
And then getting yourself set up for accurate logging, right? Knowing what tools you have to get sample accurate data or as close as possible.
Here, let me add a really quick one to that one. When games were a lot smaller, sometimes they would have half the sample rate. Most digital audio workstations will play at 44.1. So you'll throw the song in there and it's like, that does twice as fast as it should be. So you actually have to manually set it to play at half the speed because the conditions are not quite what it's expecting. So, you know, even something as simple as that.
Exactly. And then logging the music, including setting loop points and finding like exactly how the instructions, how it would be played if you were playing it in the game, but obviously outside of the context. Next item on here is getting accurate composer and production information. And this can be super time consuming and sometimes impossible. We have gone so far in certain episodes to just track down anybody who was involved in the audio so that we could show that appreciation. And, you know, sometimes we've spent hours and hours, more than any other research that we have in the episode, is trying to track down just a name. And that and to be accurate about it is quite a challenge.
Yeah, that Manabu Saito episode took me almost a month of research to make sure I had the closest I could to accurate information. Blogs, production credits, wikis, conflicting wikis, you know, there was a lot of just like figuring out what is real here.
It's one thing to just, you know, go on Wikipedia and read a few things, but it's another thing to actually cross-reference, find different sources, people close to the composers, or maybe somebody who worked in the field. That's a whole other topic in itself.
Yeah.
The next part in here is really cleaning up that audio or re-logging if there's any issues. The logging process is also about being able, if needed, to correct mistakes that were introduced during the development process, not just the composition side of it or the production side of it from the music standpoint, but maybe something in the driver was causing like a clicking noise that you wouldn't hear. I was trying to come up with a good example, but we ended up getting sidetracked, Gina. So we never got a good example here, but there's so many.
We had an episode with that racing game. I'm trying to remember what it was, the PlayStation 1 racing game, where there was just like a click every like...
Right.
Hover racing.
Yeah, that was from Electric Boogaloo. And
he went through the trouble of actually editing those out.
And so
the sound is much better than if you had heard it actually on hardware.
Right. And then that brings us to another topic, like a sub bullet of that is saying like, well, what is accurate, right? Like cleaning up logging. A lot of packs, you'll see multiple versions of the same track. And that's usually saying like, hey, here's how it sounded after it was introduced into the system, how it would sound out to a user. That is the preservation of that file. But maybe the preservation of that file is also how the composer intended it, which is not what you would hear. So there's
we'll
multiple
definitely get there.
Of that.
Yeah, we gotta hustle through. There's a lot to talk about here, but yeah,
naming and tagging all of the files. That's one. You know, compressing, optimizing the music data to save space, creating editor notes for the collections. You know, where your research comes from, XYZ. And distributing the music responsibly. Now, this is a very weirdly gray box area, and we all know it's a gray box area, but the key word here is responsibly, right? The goal of all of this isn't to hurt musicians at all or take sales away. Far from it. It's really the opposite. It's about bringing attention to this wonderful music that may or may not have been forgotten otherwise. You know, of course, there's a lot of people that do share brand new music as it comes out. That doesn't represent the majority of this community. Really, the people that are logging this are simply that much more interested in the historical side of it and also enjoying the music outside of context.
Yeah, exactly. We're going back, we're separating fact from fiction, and we're really trying to understand this as fully as we can. So with that said, I want to take a quick little music break. We've kind of dumped a lot of information at you. I have this example. It's from a game that some of you know now called Earthbound Beginnings. It was the unreleased English version of what we now know as Earthbound or Mother. It's a series that's been around for many, many years. This is a really interesting one because the English version actually had a unique second ending. And I'm going to play it right now. I'm going to play a little clip from it that was not in the Japanese version. So here we go. It's a cool track. It goes on for another minute. Yeah.
Sounds like something that would have been like a TNC Surf Designs or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. So the story with this track is kind of interesting. Well, to me, it's interesting. So I was briefly involved in an Earthbound community where we were doing some transcriptions of music from the first game to make it sound like it was in the Super NES. So we're using the sound fonts. And then I was watching the credits of this game and I'm like, that's funny. I don't remember seeing this in any of the audio files I was looking at before. And it turns out that this was added explicitly for the American version. Mind you, the American version that for 30 years was not released. You know, it was supposed to go out in 1990, 1991. So here I am sitting in like 2018 working in the community. It's like, does anybody know what's going on here? So I reached out and a person by the name of Mr. Norbert 1994 was like, huh, you're right. Let's get that music out of there. So he went through the trouble of logging it. Took him a few days to figure it out because it was stored kind of strangely. And hey, I have a very small part in helping get this music out there. We honestly had no idea that the game was ever going to get released. We figured it was just going to stay as one of these Japanese-only games that only, you know, people involved in emulation would ever be able to hear about. So it was really cool that it did come out, but we know that does not happen very often. So that said, I also want to give a special shout to Mr. Norbert 1994, who is currently one of the most prominent people in the NES login community, and they're the ones maintaining the most up-to-date NES archive out there. So if you have a game that you love and you couldn't find it, chances are it's there, but you may not have been able to find it a few years ago because this is still somewhat of an active community. Anyway, I'm going to move on from here. So we've talked a little bit about how the music is logged, but I want to actually get more concrete on how the music is stored in the games. Again, these are broad categories or broad families. We've talked a lot about this idea of music instruction data. So it's just like little, you know, small data files telling the system what to play when. I think folks know what recordings are. We'll talk a little bit about that. And of course, interactive and dynamic music. So we're going to break these down a little bit more just so, you know, and as an example to play some music. So coming up first, we have what I call instruction data plus dedicated sound hardware. So if you had a console and it had sound hardware on board that wasn't just like what we have in modern computers today, maybe it was an FM chip, maybe it was the NES sound chip, maybe it was a sample player, whatever the case, you kind of knew what hardware you had to work with. So the files were, well, the data, not even the files, were designed so that, okay, I know what to expect, this is how it plays. So again, most consoles in the 80s and 90s, a lot of PC sound cards, Japanese computer systems, and similarly, most arcade games in the 80s and 90s would have these dedicated sound cards on board. So going back to that first example, Yurei-kun from the MSX very much fits into this category. And having these small file sizes is really important when space is limited. So we talk about this kind of music a lot on our show, but I want to jump into our next example, which is something I love. This is from the game The Smurfs on the Game Boy. This track is The Mountains. I'm going to play it real quick. Some of you may know this. If you don't, hopefully you'll be surprised. It sounds great. It goes on from there. It's a wonderful track. So if you're a big fan of VGM, if you've gone really deep in the weeds, you may already know this track. But for a lot of folks, you may never have heard the name Alberto Jose Gonzalez. He was pretty unknown for a very long time, at least in the US, because most of his work was on European licensed games like Smurfs, Asterix and Obelix, Tintin, on Nintendo consoles and handhelds. And nobody in Europe really cared about those things in the 90s. So honestly, almost nobody was listening to this music except for, like, you know, 10-year-olds that got a Smurfs game. So here we have this guy making really amazing video game music that's as good as some of the stuff that we know because it was in a much, much more popular game. And now because of logging, we're able to hear it much more easily. And in the community, Alberto Gonzalez has become something of a household name. I mean, not really, but, you know, much more prominent than he used to be.
Yeah, and he, you know, he shares stuff on, you know, Twitter, Facebook, and all sorts of old stuff that he has worked on. And he's like the nicest, sweetest guy ever. And his music is just indistinguishable from a lot of other stuff. You can always listen and hear an Alberto Jose Gonzalez track and know exactly who's it comes from. So,
all right, Brian, you want to take this section?
Sure thing. What do we got next? Yeah. Self-contained music is the kind of next quote unquote bullet point that we want to talk about here. And if you've been in, like, you know, tracking communities, demo scene, stuff like that, you'd be familiar with it. A lot of these are self-contained files that include all of the samples and the instructions to play back. So these are usually mod files or different, you know, tracker style music or tracker files. They're very portable. You can transfer them from one machine to another. As long as you have a playback engine, you're totally fine. Very popular for hobbyists, musicians outside of games. Really big on, you know, in the 80s and 90s on the Amiga, you know, C64 mm-hmm. and PC, which is why they just became like basically this was trackers were the like the number one use in the West, especially for creating music for computers, early computer systems.
Believe it or not, this was like the easiest way to talk to the computer before we had really sophisticated audio workstations or any of these tools. So they were very popular for quite a while.
Right. Now, you're not streaming audio like an MP3 or Wave or something like that. These, you know, maybe like an MP3 would take up, you know, like 5 megs or something like that. But since all the samples are small and reused here, the instructions are relatively just text. They take up significantly less data. Still take up more than maybe, say, you know, the instructions to, you know, an NES or a Game Boy, but still a lot less data because still at the time there was memory limitations. And so this played a big role in how developers and composers, sound engineers had to work with the software they used. The Super NES, for example, uses samples and song data. It's very similar to this, but it wasn't until logging that a lot of that music became available outside of the commercial games. It's a lot easier to access something like a mod file, again, this tracker music, with home computers in mind. So,
yeah, we're going to move on to our next track, but I do want to say, unlike that first example, this is actually pretty close to how the file actually looks. People are writing in, you know, C7, play, you know, this, whatever, for how many notes. It's not the easiest thing to understand, but it is pretty space efficient. You know, when you have a rectangular, you know, a square monitor and not a good resolution. So I'm going to move on to our next track, which is an example of this. Tell us a little bit about this one, Brian.
Okay, yeah. So Ice Toxin, this is from Unreal on PC, and this was composed by Andrew Sega, it uses a custom format, UMX. It can be read, that last screenshot that we just saw was actually music from this game. Why don't we go ahead and play that, and then we'll talk about it a little bit.
Sounds good.
We'll be right back.
Nice.
Awesome. Yeah. We were just talking about this the other day, Gene and I. You know, there's a certain style of people that that like this old, like, kind of 90s techno trance kind of stuff that was really
you grew
big
up
in
with
games.
It, yeah.
Yeah, if you grew up with it. Yeah. So this was Epic developed, Epic Mega Games, they developed their own custom format, UMX, which they were used in several different games. The entire soundtrack is less than 100 megabytes, and it's over an hour of music. So that kind of gives you an idea of, you know, they use a lot of large samples and stuff like that, which adds to the file size. But at the end of the day, 100 megabytes, an hour of music, that's pretty good for back then, before compression was really, really, you know, kind of tamed. The Unreal Engine to this day remains a very popular game engine in development. So, don't jump the gun.
Sorry about that. Yeah. Just trying to keep an eye on the time. Yeah.
No, we're good. We're good. But yeah, real quick, last note on mod music is, because of how user-friendly the format is, software developers often wrote their own tools and custom formats. So if you look at the Amiga lifespan, just in the Amiga, there's over 150 different, like, mod style formats for a system that was almost exclusively developed around sample playback.
So that's a logger's challenge. It's kind of a nightmare, actually, to to translate all of those different formats.
Right. Luckily, there's some good tools out there that have been worked on for decades now to get this back. But, you know, it is a challenge.
I'm moving us along to a topic that I love talking about, but I sometimes don't like listening to. I'm referring to MIDIs here as generic music data, because unlike the previous examples, they are truly generic. They don't necessarily know what kind of audio hardware you're going to get. Sometimes it's specific, sometimes it's not. Because for those of you that know, MIDI was a standard that was formalized in the 80s, just so you could communicate between, you know, musical instrument digital interface. That's what that stands for. So synthesizers and computers and things could talk to each other. It's truly just generic instruction information. In fact, a lot of it looks very similar to what you saw in those screenshots with lots of hexadecimal values. In the 90s, you started to get libraries like General MIDI, and General MIDI was kind of a best effort to have something that everybody could play, even if you didn't have really good hardware. It gets a lot of a bad rap, but, you know, it's... Even General MIDI can sound pretty good, but the big, big advantage is, of course, portability and the very small file sizes. So yes, Canyon.mid, I see that coming up in the chat, a favorite of pretty much everybody. And so the example that I picked out was from System Shock by Greg LaPiccolo. For those of you who haven't played System Shock, it has a very kind of General MIDI-ish soundtrack, but I think it still sounds pretty cool. that's really them showing, you know, just working within the limitations, knowing that they had MIDI devices. Every version of the soundtrack I've ever had has had this kind of like very, very MIDI-ish sound. And the only real difference is it uses a different MIDI format, but for all intents and purposes, it is the same thing as just a regular MIDI with a few extra controls. It's not going to change how it sounds, not really. What I found really interesting was I found a post on System Shock. This was logged originally way back in like 1998 and put out into the broader internet. So people have been interested in doing this kind of work and preserving it and sharing it with folks for a long, long time. Here's an interesting little fact for you. I think some of you may know that Final Fantasy VII on PlayStation 1 actually used MIDI because of space reasons. But the PC version did as well. I just recently discovered this when researching for the show. There were actually four different complete sets of MIDI files for the PC game for exactly this reason, because they didn't know what hardware you would have. So here's MIDIs if you have just like something, or the AWE line of chips, or sound cards. So yeah, they and they have differences between them too. So they don't all sound quite the same, and there's different like effects and things applied. So this was a lot of work. And you know how huge Final Fantasy VII is. It's probably, what, 80 tracks long? So all that, yeah, it's like 400 songs completely. It's crazy.
Which is funny, because that opens a whole can of worms, right? Because like even before, like I have an MT32 behind me over there, and like that's even before General MIDI. So like
I forgot to mention this, but the funny thing about MIDI is that it seems like it'd be straightforward, but everybody gets so attached to their own hardware. Like, oh, I listen to it on the Sound Blaster, or I listen to it on the SC88, and it's got to sound like that. So you have these people that go through the trouble of logging it on hardware so it sounds just like how they remember it. So you've got dozens of these for even a single game.
One thing that I want to bring up that is just incredible is we have a good friend of the show and somebody who's very prominent in the logging community, Valley Bell, who has all of this hardware, like SC55 and, you know, SC88 Pro, MT32, and will play back a lot of these MIDI files on that hardware just to see what it would have been like on these different things. And so that's a whole other layer of like logging and trying to replicate something that these small kind of combinations of systems that people might have had.
Yeah. Every one of these is a giant can of worms. We've got about 15 minutes left, so we got to breeze through this.
We're good.
We're doing all right. So, Brian, tell us about recordings and streaming audio. We got a great example for this one.
Right. This is the most straightforward and easiest to understand, but in some ways, it's the least interesting. It's basically pre-baked audio files, right? So you can play these back on an audio player, maybe like Redbook Audio or something, for example. You tend to see a lot of this in the 90s, in the early days of CD-based games. So not sure if you had a Sega CD or maybe a Saturn or a PlayStation, and every once in a while you get lucky, if you were a nerd like us, and you could put it in a CD player and see what comes out. Every now and then, that would work. Redbook Audio. You know, the files were relatively small to today's standards, but back then,
huge.
Really ate up ate up a whole CD and didn't give you much left for like a data. So Gene was talking about using MIDI data for Final Fantasy VII or PlayStation's equivalent of MIDI for Final Fantasy VII. That's because the game needed so much data for the actual game itself that they couldn't, you know, load it up with all of these, you know, orchestral, you know, waves, right?
Which is why later games ended up switching to like these other formats, because, well, if half of the game disc is taken up by audio, that means I have to make the game smaller. No, music loses. Sorry.
We had a really good conversation with Iwadare-san, who did the music for the Lunar series. And he made a very, you know, cautious example of saying like, hey, look, I prefer the music in the Sega CD version because it was exactly how I intended it. The problem was all of his music in Lunar had to be less than a minute long, I think, was the requirement. And then it also had to be able to loop correctly. And so that restriction he had made the files really small, fit in that space, but also he could only have like 12 songs. So everything else would have to translate to some other kind of audio format. And then Lunar for PlayStation, when it was redone, I think had to go back to the MIDI style.
Let's play our recorded audio sample. And this one is another great one. This is from Interstate 76. This is the track Vigilante Shuffle. We'll be right back. sorry. That's a good track. I don't want to cut those off either, but the funny thing about this track is it was just some band members that especially like three or four of these
you've never heard of.
Yeah, you know, Third Eye Blind, Santana, Guns N' Roses, who cares? You know, but essentially they were tasked with a project they made together, like a little mini supergroup. Put on a fun, like, 70s funk-inspired soundtrack to go with the... It's like a dream project, right? It's like, yeah, you don't have to, like, be your band. Make whatever you want, just as long as it kind of, like, fits this weird vibe. So that's what they did. It's really cool.
Yeah. But even something as simple as recorded audio, there's still a lot of challenges, right? So recordings can take up a lot of space, bandwidth. We mentioned this earlier. Sometimes they're actually compressed into other formats. And then you have to untangle, like Gene mentioned earlier on... In the talk about, you know, kind of decrypting everything that they had to do to maybe make this file a lot smaller.
Yeah. We're on to our last example, and this is going to be a little bit on the short side just because it's kind of hard to talk about dynamic audio. It's really not our area of expertise, but you've probably played games nowadays that take full advantage of this. It's immersive based on what is going on in the game. The way that it plays out in the music is maybe... you have something get added, you know, the string section comes in or comes out, you know, the mood changes, the tempo changes, all sorts of these different things that we can move dynamically through the game. And if you want to learn more about this, we had a really great interview with the composer Chase Bethea in our show 156. He did a live demo for us about how he used dynamic audio in a game. So it's in that recording. It's really great.
Cool. Some examples. We have the Nier example, right?
Yeah. I was going to just play a really, really quick example from Nier. So... I try to keep this clip as short as possible, but the way it works is there's a town square. There's a lady playing sort of a string instrument. As you get closer, you hear her singing. When you start a conversation, the singing cuts out. And then as soon as the conversation ends, she starts singing again. And pretty much as long as you're within a certain radius, the music gets louder and quieter. It's really cool. So here it is. Just like a little short conversation.
It's just a song. I don't know what it means.
What kind of idiot sings a song without knowing what it means?
This kind of idiot? Look, why don't you go to the library and ask Popola? She's smarter than me. Maybe she knows.
Popola, huh? All right.
It's a beautiful song, and yeah, I even threw that nerd word in there, diegetic music. So games nowadays can do the same thing that films do when somebody turns on the the CD player and you're hearing the same thing that they are. It's as if it's happening in the world. So I threw this in there. For those of us that remember Final Fantasy VI, the opera scene is kind of probably game's first experience with this in a big way. But ever since then, it's become super duper common, and it's awesome, and it makes games that much more immersive and expressive.
One of the examples we had, I think at our talk at the Library of Congress, was the like Banjo-Kazooie, for example. Your music's playing bubbly, really bubbly music. You jump into the water, and all of a sudden, the music takes on a new shape. It's the same track, but it has more of a, you know, ethereal kind of feel to it, and Curse of Monkey Island. There's so many examples now. Red Dead Redemption that do this, and it really creates this much more immersive experience.
Yeah, exactly. We're getting close to the end, but I do want to breeze through a couple of things. Brian, do you want to kind of just really quickly talk about some of this stuff?
Oh yeah, the different audio formats. This is, you know, again,
this is
like
deep into
five
weeds,
other five other topics all in one. But you know, some of the formats the logging community does. You know, we talked about custom formats. Somebody has to write specifications for these, right? So the NES has its own NSF sound format, which was developed back in, what, 99? Something like that, by Kevin Horton. Yeah, it's used for everything. People know it now. It's got seven different kinds with the expansion audios, 50, 60 hertz, support for different regions of music, all over the place. There's
everything under one umbrella.
Right. You got things like file formats that you need to have a way to play this stuff back. So authors have written things like VGM Play, right? Valley Bell wrote VGM Play, and there's, you know, Winamp plugins. Yes, people still use Winamp because it's a great way to play back music. And ZX Tune, stuff like this, a lot more to be able to kind of faithfully listen to this music back, or this music data back, through something that that can kind of translate it into something we can listen to easily.
Yeah, and this one is really interesting. This is super deep in the weeds, but the super crazy dedicated folks are, if they're unhappy with the way the sound goes, they will go and write better emulation code. So if you're familiar with a project like MAME, which is an arcade emulator, there's an entire dedicated community of people that write better audio. So, you know, you're playing a game and it actually sounds correctly. It's a whole separate thing. And so some of those same folks are actually working on these kinds of things. So the playback isn't quite right in these formats. So we got to figure out, is it because of the format or is it because of the emulation? Oh, we're not actually capturing some aspect of the sound chip. We have to go back and rework some of this stuff. So yeah, it's crazy deep.
I do want to call out CTR, who is a good friend of us.
Yes.
And is so fundamental to, main project for audio reasons, and also developed some really great tools like Quattro Play, basically playing back, you know, just some amazing music that otherwise wasn't easy to play back, and has patched MAME and made you know, the audio actually a lot better, even down to the finest, most like fine grained details of a single track in a single game. You know, he really puts a lot of effort to make this accessible to everybody, or available for others to listen to. It's incredible.
It is amazing. And honestly,
we need to get him on the show again sometime.
We do,
for sure.
We do.
He's a really good guy.
So we started off this talk by saying the communities behind VGM, and we haven't really mentioned that many of them because this is another gigantic rabbit hole. So we're going to leave the screenshot up. We're going to talk a little bit about them, but we really don't have time. But the truth is, there's so many of these out there. Projects, some of them have been going on 20-something years. On the right, we have more of the European computers. On the left, we have more consoles and arcades, more of the Japanese side. VGM RIPS, which is a multi-chip source, so you can get music from arcade games, console games, SNES music, hopefully self-explanatory, SMS Power for Master System and Game Gear. I'm not going to run through the list entirely. It's mind-boggling to me just how many people hours have been put into all of this work over the years. It's crazy. It's just so humbling and amazing. And my introduction to VGM almost 20 years ago was finding, I think, the Commodore 64 archive and being like,
yep,
a whole new world of music has opened to me. I didn't even know this existed. It was amazing. Yeah.
That's a really good playback too.
Yeah. But I also want to say that this is not some esoteric thing, some secret club. You can join too. Almost every one of these websites that you go to, especially the larger communities, they'll say, hey, do you want to contribute? Join the forum.
Yeah.
Message, email this person. Do this. Here are the instructions for how to participate. They really do want this to be a community effort. It's not like secret safeguarding.
Yeah, there's nothing like, you know, everybody, really, the end goal is what we've been kind of preaching this whole time, really, is to archive and enjoy outside of context some of this music that would otherwise be lost, right? So, you know, we had VGM RIPS on there. That's a community that we're very close with. And a lot of those, you know, folks have been, you know, friends of mine for years. And, you know, we do our best to contribute back the ways that we can. And the communities, there's new people getting involved in creating packs and being able to do this work. And I know it seems like it's a slog to put together a lot of these packs, but it's also really rewarding when you put something together and know that you helped get this music out to so many other people. And it's such a cool feeling, and people really appreciate it. I think people really do, especially in the community.
Yeah. We're running out on time pretty much, but I do want to just very, very, very quickly touch on this. I think we all sort of dance around this topic collectively as a community. The legal aspect of VGM is very, very complicated. Suffice it to say, the reason why we especially tend to focus on older music is because the games have been out so long, especially lesser known games. We're not here, as we said, to take money away from artists. Some game companies have started to figure out ways to
monetize
to bring back some of these. But that's a very, very small majority of this. An arcade game developer that went out of business 25 years ago, without these efforts, you're never going to hear that music again. You know, for some people, that's not a big deal. But for us that just loves this stuff, you know, it really is important for us to preserve it. And again, it's a bit of a legal gray area, but we try, you know, especially for our show, we really do our best to make sure that we're not doing anything that's going to get in the way of any artist. If we play anything from a new game, it's always with the explicit permission of the composer, or we have them on, you know, stuff like that.
We've had so many people on that have told us, like composers that have said, wow, you don't know how good that feels to say, to share this music with other people. You guys, you know, are talking about music that I wrote, you know, 40 something years ago. And it feels so crazy to me that people still care. And well, maybe they do, because now they're able to listen to it. We are starting to run out of time, but the importance here really is that, you know, it really is about the preservation, and it's not taking money out of anybody's hand, and nobody is trying to make money out of this. Really what it comes down to is exploration and allowing others to explore something new. If you're really a huge fan of game audio and more of the popular stuff, you know, Mario, Zelda, Contra, whatever, like, I really invite you to go listen to stuff that you maybe haven't heard, and I guarantee that you'll find that there's some stuff out there that just will have you in love in new ways.
Right. And, you know, I had a whole long slide here, but just to keep things very simple. I mean, really, this is about archiving game history. It's getting access to tons of great music that we wouldn't be able to hear otherwise. And I have this bullet point here about access having an equalizing effect. I don't think many of us would have ever heard of Alberto Jose Gonzalez without it. And I'm actually going to play one last example before we wrap up the show, just sort of a quick thanks. This is from a game that I never would have figured out or heard of in any way without this community. This is from the game Star Trader. It's the title theme. It's called Launching. It was originally composed by Miyako Ishikawa from the Falcom Sound Team. Unfortunately, you're going to have to listen to the full show to hear the rest of that track or search for it yourself. It's an amazing track. Miyako Ishikawa is a wonderful composer. And, you know, the thing is that I kind of want to just reinforce, her name was completely unknown because she just got encapsulated in this whole Falcom sound team. But now we know she wrote the music and we can seek out other stuff that she wrote. This kind of stuff just does not happen by accident. This is just the result of hours and hours of time-consuming work of really dedicated people, and we're just so proud to be a part of that community. So, yeah, don't forget to thank those people in the logging community and the many related communities like it. You know, emulation, translation, it's a whole big, messy kind of world. And hopefully, you know, you have gotten just a little bit more appreciation for all of this in your own music production or music making or listening. It doesn't really matter. We love all this stuff.
Awesome. Anyways, thank you so much for joining us today and listening to us talk about all of this logging community stuff. Hopefully it interests you. I'm sure it does because you're here at this event. So
yeah,
thank you for joining. You can always email us, go to our Twitter at Pixelated Audio. Find us online at pixelatedaudio.com. Join our Discord. There is a lot of people who are talking about logging in there and how to preserve audio, and sharing and really just being part of this community is awesome. Yeah, thanks everybody so much for taking the time out of your day to come join us.
Yeah. Thank you, VGM Together.